What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
I think that informed the kind of documentaries that I gravitated towards wanting to make, which were not issue-oriented so much stories, but even though the issues are there, but stories, you know, following stories.
Documentary filmmaker Steve James has made some of the most compelling nonfiction narratives of the past couple decades, from his landmark debut Hoop Dreams to The Interrupters and Life Itself. James's films are defined by the intelligence, integrity, and empathy that he brings to his work. His latest, Abacus Small Enough to Jail, plays this year's Chicago International Film Festival, which opened this week. This past summer, I had a chance to sit down with James for a career-spanning conversation. That talk ahead on Film Spotting. It was only fitting that when I was preparing to host a talk with the great Chicago-based documentary director Steve James back in June of this year, I got a sense of what it must be like to be a documentary filmmaker. I started with hours and hours of footage collected over several years, a couple decades in fact, found layers and layers of common and disparate threads, and I had to figure out a way to distill it all down to a tidy two-hour feature. That 2 hours is going to be even further distilled here, as we're only going to be able to get to about an hour of my conversation. We'll play part two at a later date. One of my goals with the talk was to focus on some of James' less familiar projects. I figured you could find plenty of material out there and plenty of interviews with him talking about movies like Hoop Dreams and like The Interrupters, but I wanted to emphasize some of his more obscure films, including The New Americans, the James-produced doc series about new immigrants, the Texas-based death penalty doc At the Death House Door, and Stevie, his divisive and very personal documentary about revisiting a troubled old acquaintance. But in talking about these films, James does share great insight into the nuts and bolts of nonfiction storytelling, how he collaborates with the crew, how he chooses to insert himself into the narrative, and how he settles on a story to tell. Now, like a lot of documentary filmmakers, I played with the chronology a bit. I wanted to focus on motifs and material instead of going through a linear tour of his filmography. I did, however, for my first question, start at the beginning. James is not a born and bred Chicagoan, like many people who watch his films may believe. He has long been associated with Chicago, of course, but he's originally from Hampton, Virginia, something I learned, appropriately enough, from watching one of his documentaries, No Crossover, The Trial of Allen Iverson, his 2010 ESPN 30 for 30 doc. I asked him to start to describe his childhood.
Wow. Well, it was not very distinctive. But I think what was interesting about it, and that I think informed the kinds of films that I've mostly tried to make as a filmmaker, is that, you know, I grew up in a community that was, you know, mostly black and white. The high school I went to was almost 50-50 black and white. My dad's business was in, you know, as is indicated in the No Crossover film, because it has this personal thread in it, because Allen Iverson was from my hometown. That's where that, how that comes into play. But, you know, he had a business that was in what was called a dicey part of town, a black part of town. But yet, where I lived was in a redneck part of town, very white. Black people didn't hardly venture there, much less live there. I lived on the fringes of that. The deeper you went into that community, the more redneck it became and the more Confederate flags you saw. So I had this kind of, you know, and I also played basketball at the high school and had a lot of black teammates. And so I kind of lived this very weird life growing up in Hampton that brought me in touch with some really racist communities, but also brought me in various ways in touch with the black community. And so I think that really informed, when I became a filmmaker, the things that fascinated and interested me. So race was something that very much interested me.
You get a glimpse in No Crossover, obviously, of your upbringing. Your father, as a business owner, your father was, your mother worked for a while at a high school where she was the nurse.
Right.
It seems that there was a fairly progressive upbringing, at least for relative to maybe the environment that you just described. Did that also, your parents' influence specifically, influence your work now?
Well, it's funny because my mom was when I was growing up, she was a Democrat, and she actually was active in the Democratic Party locally. My dad was a Republican, but my dad was like the good kind of Republican. You know, he was that doesn't hardly exist anymore. But you know, the kind of Republican who had some very conservative ideas about, you know, he was conservative in his own personal values in a lot of way, and fiscally conservative and all of those kind of things. But he was comfortable around black people and had a long-term black employee, one of the you know, installers that worked for him for over 30 years that I helped on jobs in the summer. So, you know, he was active in the Lions Club and in the community. So he was a good guy, but he was conservative, you know, in his political, you know, I don't think he ever voted Democratic in his life.
He was also generally a supporter of Allen Iverson at a time when people weren't in the
exactly.
community.
Exactly. I mean, I think that was because my dad was a terrific athlete. He was an all-state football player in high school and went to the same high school that I eventually went to. You know, he was like a much better athlete than I ever was, but sports was his way in to kind of, and much the same way it was for me too. The sports was his way in to kind of grappling with race in a different way. Because, you know, when he played football for Hampton High School, it was an all-white school. By the time I came along and all those years he was cheering for the team, the football team was probably 90% black. But he was dutifully out there every weekend cheering the Crabbers. We were called the Crabbers. Cheering the Crabbers on. And yeah, he wished there were more white kids playing for the team, but it didn't dampen his enthusiasm for the tradition of that school and the team, you know, because they were always very good at football.
How important generally were movies to you growing up?
Movies weren't very important to me. My dad loved Charlton Heston. So I saw a lot of the movies I tended to see in the theater with him were Charlton Heston movies. We went to see Ben-Hur, I remember, and several of the Ten Commandments, of course. And that was fun to go see. I would occasionally go see movies, of course, on my own. And I say there are two profoundly significant movie-going experiences from my youth that I think informed my life. One was, for some odd reason, I went to see Bonnie and Clyde when it came out by myself at the local theater. So this is like 1967.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty young. I don't know how I even got in to see that movie, but I was just completely blown away by that, and that stuck with me. The other was a family movie that we went to see. My dad, of course, engineered this because we were a sports mad family. So we went to see this film called Paper Lion, which was based on a George Plimpton writer who used to write for Sports Illustrated and other places, article where he went and during the preseason, he was a quarterback for the Detroit Lions. He did all these experiential things in sports, like he boxed Sugar Ray Robinson for a round and got his butt kicked. And then
pitched at Yankee Stadium.
So I just remember seeing that movie and being exhilarated by it. When we came out of the theater as a family, having gone see this movie, I remember just having this exhilaration that I felt like I had peeked behind the curtain of pro football. Because it had all these real football players in it, like Alex Karras' first starring role before he went on to great fame in Blazing Saddles and Punching Horses.
Webster.
Out. Yes. But I just remember this, like, wow, I got it. I got to see what it really is like behind the scenes of pro football. And I actually think that planted a seed in me that eventually would come to flower, if you will, as in documentary, because I think that many of us who make documentaries, a big part of the appeal of it is being able to delve behind the curtains of people's lives or institutions or whatever and get a view that you don't get otherwise.
I get the sense that you were fairly realistic about your options athletically after high school. So what did you aspire to do as you're looking to go off to college?
Yeah, I figured out my junior year that I was not going to be recruited by a Division I school and go on and play in the NBA after that. Yeah, I don't know how I ever even thought that might be a possibility. It's pretty interesting. But I was not a good student in high school. I was not stupid, although I thought I was. And so when high school ended, I didn't really have any aspirations that I can remember. In fact, my parents said, I think you should go to college. And I was like, okay. And so I kind of went off to college with no goals or aspirations. It just felt like something I should do. When I got there, I took various courses, but then I started to work at the radio station. They had an NPR station there, and I worked there, and I kind of fell in love with radio journalism as a result of that experience. And so for a while, I thought I would pursue journalism, but radio journalism. But then junior year, I took this film appreciation class in the English department that this really passionate teacher named Ralph Cohen taught. And we studied the work of Ernst Lubitsch, Jean Renoir, Alfred Hitchcock, and Arthur Penn. And that was the, you know, that point I was like, this is what I want to do. I had no idea how I'd do it, but that's what I decided I want to do. And that eventually led to grad school at Southern Illinois, and that's what got me to this state. And I ended up getting an MFA in film and then coming up here.
So that's the cinematic awakening. When does the documentary awakening happen?
I think it kind of kicked in at Southern, because the best teacher there, a guy named Mike Covell, he was a kind of an experimental documentary filmmaker, but also made more conventional or whatever documentaries too, and loved documentary. And I think that was where I got kind of hooked. And I think what happened was is that the documentary part of it combined that interest in journalism that I'd had before I fell in love with film, coupled with wanting to tell stories. And I think that informed the kind of documentaries that I gravitated towards wanting to make, which were not issue-oriented so much stories, but even though the issues are there, but stories, you know, following stories, trying to make narrative documentary instead of Inconvenient Truth or that kind of approach.
One of the documentaries you've listed as a big influence on you was Harlan County, USA, Barbara Koppel's 1976 documentary, great film, yeah, that documents the 1973 coal miner strike in Kentucky. And I can see why it would, obviously, looking at your films in terms of the way she embeds herself in a community with very kind of a very rigid structure and set of rules and tradition, the cultural divide that's on display there in terms of her also chronicling this struggle of the impoverished. It's all, yeah, elements we do see in your films. Talk about the influence of that film and when you remember seeing it.
Yeah, well, I saw it in grad school. I was blown away by it. I think there's many great scenes in the movie, but I think the thing that stuck with me the most or impressed me the most was just the commitment that she made to being in this community over an extended period of time and winning the trust of people to be allowed inside, you know, behind that curtain, if you will. And you hear her occasionally asking a question, and you know she's not from there. You know, she's a New Yorker. And that impressed me, too, that this person from outside that community was able to kind of go to a place that she probably had very little experience with and penetrate it and win the trust and tell this story and the commitment that it took to tell that story over a period of time.
As we get into your films here directly, I want to talk about something that I think Koppel does very well in that film, which is she gives voice to people who are usually voiceless, who are, yeah, kind of on the fringes, who you wouldn't otherwise hear from, really, except for maybe a few seconds on the news that night, that this is going on in Kentucky, but the way she really embedded herself there. And we've seen that in a few of your films in particular. And I think I want to talk about a movie, a series like The New Americans, where it's from 2004, ran on PBS, 7 hours following immigrants from several different countries as they come to the United States and all seek, they have different reasons for coming, all of them, but ultimately it's all about hopefully having a better life, about, right, finding some kind of opportunity. Just take us back to the beginning of that, the undertaking of that, where it's you, it's several other directors and editors and many collaborators, a very huge undertaking. Where did the germ of the idea come from?
Yeah, well, I think the germ of the idea was probably born from two places. One, at the time that the idea came to me, there was the primaries going on leading to the election. So that would have been probably in, would have been 2000. Patrick Buchanan, the arch conservative, was running for the Republican nomination, and he was talking about closing the borders with Mexico. and that, you know, it kind of sounds similar to somebody else that's running right now, actually. And I remember thinking, you know, I mean, I'm not a Patrick Buchanan supporter, I'm a liberal guy, but I do remember thinking, America's changing dramatically. We were experiencing then, and we continue to experience now, a huge influx of folks coming to America from all over, but especially at that time, and still true today, I think, from Mexico and Central America. And I remember thinking, like, if I look in my heart of hearts a little bit, I'm not, like, sure how I feel about things like illegal immigration, you know, like should we just let anyone come who wants to come, or should we really be restricting this in some ways? And some of the things that I thought about didn't fit with my liberal politics, but if I was honest with myself, it was like, well, I don't, you know, who are these people who are coming? It was kind of a fundamental question. The other thing that was going on at the time, which is much less, you know, up there, was that I was traveling quite a bit, and whenever I would travel to a city or come home, but especially traveling, like, say, to New York or in particular, you know, I would end up with cabs, and I would inevitably end up with immigrants. And, you know, if you do this a lot, if you encourage cab drivers, they love to generally tell you their life story, right? If you give them the opening, they will tell you their life story. And, of course, I loved, so it'd be like over the span of a half-hour cab ride, I would get the life story of a immigrant cab driver. And I was just utterly fascinated and riveted by just about every one of them. And I just got to thinking about both those things and thinking it would be great to do a contemporary story of immigration, not historical, but contemporary, and that the thing that would be different, at least that I had not seen, would be that I would love to start with them before they come here, if that's possible, so that we really see what their lives are like in the country they come from and have some sense of what they expect to find. Because a lot of these cab drivers would talk about, like, well, I came here and I thought it was going to be this and it ended up being that. And they weren't all, like, bitter at all, but it was just, you know, things weren't what, right? So I thought what would be fascinating would be to do that, to follow it over time and start with them in their country of origin or in a refugee camp. So I brought the idea to Kartemkin and to Gordon in particular, and he loved the idea of doing this, and we just kind of went about trying to raise the money to get it underway. There were two things that I think we knew early on. One was is that we wanted to have teams of filmmakers that could follow these stories, because they were going to not just all be located in Chicago and couldn't easily be followed. We wanted it to really be a national thing, and an international, literally. The other thing that really excited me about it from the get-go was, I don't want to tell each story individually. Like, tonight's episode is the, you know, the Palestinian story, and tomorrow night tune in for the Dominican Republic story. I wanted to interweave them, because it struck me that one of the things that would really be exciting creatively, but also more revealing, would be is to compare and contrast the experiences of these very different immigrants and coming to America for very different reasons from very different backgrounds.
Yeah, seeing the shared experiences and the common threads in those stories is really one of the real thrills of that series, I think. You mentioned the different storylines and different teams of directors. You had a larger view, or a larger role in that series as a producer and as an editor, but you specifically directed the Nigerian story following Israel and his wife Ngozi as they come to Chicago. And they're fleeing from Nigeria. They are coming as refugees, leaving a pretty terrible situation behind. Why did you choose that one to direct?
I don't know. I liked the idea of trying to tell a refugee story. That appealed to me. We kind of recruited our team of filmmakers first and then found stories. So the refugee story just kind of came about, like many stories do, through a combination of serendipitousness. You know, we talked to the United Nations High Command on Refugees, and they got us into a camp, and then the Nigerians were interesting, and then we found them. And
jumping back in here just for a second. At this point in the conversation, we played a long clip from James' episode of The New Americans, one that played a bit better on the screen than it would here on the radio or podcast. So I do want to explain it briefly. In the scene, James and his crew are in Nigeria. The subjects of his storyline, the refugees Israel and Ngozi, are not able to return to their homeland, so they've sent a video letter in their stead for their families to watch. I wanted James to talk about his recollections of the scene, shooting it as a director, what he was doing physically, trying to capture that footage, and then later as an editor, putting it together.
Well, it always helps to hire a good DP. and Dana Cupper, who has worked with me many times over the years, starting with Stevie, and she was the DP on that. And Adam Singer did sound and was a collaborator on that as well. So these are people I've worked with a lot. Adam goes back to Hoop Dreams. You know, so it helps to have a team together that's kind of in sync. And you know, I think in those situations, it's interesting because there's already a lot going on, right? And so part of what's a challenge for us is that we don't speak the language. And we weren't in a position. Sometimes when you're shooting in a foreign country or in a foreign language situation, you can do it. They did it on the Palestinian story. You can have someone there who is a translator on one of your audio tracks to your headsets, kind of loosely translating what's going on. That would have been nice, but we didn't have that. We did have someone helping us out with some translations here and there on the fly, but in this situation, we kind of had to just read, and Dana had to kind of, you have to read the situation and kind of read what's going on. And even though you don't know exactly what's being said, you kind of have to sense, and you do, what's going on here and point the camera in the right directions. And then, of course, it's all about maintaining coverage and getting coverage. And you know, no matter how sort of wonderful a situation might be that you're filming in and you might be captivated by it, you need to remember that you're going to want to edit it in all likelihood. and so you have to give yourself the tools and the ability, the images to do that with. And so how hands-on I am in a particular moment really depends on the moment and depends on if I feel like the camera, if someone else is shooting. Sometimes more recently I've been shooting, so it's kind of my fault if I don't get it, but it's my fault anyway. But you know, how hands-on you are is a kind of dependent a little bit on the situation and when I'm observing what Dana's doing. I try to stay near the DP so I can whisper in their ear about things I want because I don't want to draw attention to myself. Or sometimes they understand that I may literally physically grab them and flip them around in another direction if I feel like there's something over here they absolutely have to get right now and I don't want to have to go, excuse me, there's something really interesting going on, or are we, you know. And they don't take it personally. But you also have to learn to keep your hands off, too, literally and figuratively, because your DP, I learned this the hard way in Hoop Dreams. Peter Gilbert, who was my partner on Hoop Dreams and a fabulous shooter, among other things, we shot a lot of basketball games on Hoop Dreams. And there was a period of time where I got more and more like directing of when we would shoot certain games. And he would defer to some degree and kind of do that. And when I got into editing, I saw this one sequence of a basketball game we shot during the Arthur's March to the state tournament, and I was marveling at the coverage of it. And then it suddenly dawned on me that I wasn't there, and that Peter had gotten it really well without me there whispering in his ear. And so that was a good lesson for me to learn, because it's like, yeah, you've got to give your DP that faith, because they will perform better too. So you have to be... It's a delicate balance.
I'm sure it depends on the project and the situation and maybe funding to an extent as well, but is that three-person crew, sound person, camera, and you typically your
yes.
operation?
Yes, either three or two. Like on Hoop Dreams, you know, I probably did about half the sound myself, and I told Adam did just about all the rest of it, Adam Singer, and I told Adam we'd have a credit in the credits saying good sound Adam Singer, bad sound, you know, me, but we didn't do that. But yeah, it's a lot of times it's two or three, rarely more than that if we can help it, because the intimacy part of it numbers make a difference in terms of the intimacy.
Your role today, Arthur, is to impress the coaches, try not to be too fancy. You take the open shot when you have it. Play good defense and make good passes. The rest of it, just play natural, you know.
I'm hoping I'm going to go to St. Joe and play. But first, I gotta get my book straight. And hopefully come out and impress the coaches.
Is it kind of scary?
Yes, it is.
More from my June conversation with Steve James in just a bit when we get to probably the most infamous film in the James filmography and probably my favorite James film, 2002 Stevie, which had James checking in with a troubled young man that he'd known a decade earlier. Stay with us.
I haven't seen the place since 68 when we all got high and we rolled that tape. Hold up, waiting for a call from the man who crashes by.
Doing here?
I came to see my lawyer.
Well, my wife wants me out of the house.
You can't keep coming here.
Your wife works for you.
No, she's the boss, actually.
I wonder how much more there might be buried here. I was so afraid I'd get out of law school and be selling shoes. My mom works in a school cafeteria, my sister in a hospital laundry, so selling shoes is the nicest job a girl from my family's supposed to get.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, a clip there from the latest film from one of our favorite directors here on the show, Kelly Reichert. She brought us Wendy and Lucy, Meek's Cutoff, among others. Some of the trailer there from Reichert's Certain Women, which opens in Chicago on the 21st and will be out in limited release. Certain Women stars Kristen Stewart, Laura Dern, and Reichert regular Michelle Williams. Next week, more of me asking a bunch of questions. My interview with Reichert, along with Josh's thoughts on her new film. And speaking of Certain Women, it does open on the 21st, as I mentioned, but you have a chance to see it before it opens. If you are in the Chicago area, we are giving away free advanced screening passes to see the film on October 17th. If you want to enter to win those passes, you can do so now at filmspotting.net. There's a link right there in the top stories. You can also win passes to see Ewan McGregor's adaptation of Philip Roth's American Pastoral. That screening is October 18th. In Chicago. And as we've been doing lately here on the show, we want to highlight the upcoming Chicago Podcast Festival. We are part of that festival. All three Film Spotting family shows, Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show, are part of the fest. We will perform along with the SVU folks on Friday the 18th and then The Next Picture Show on the 19th. They'll be performing at Steppenwolf. We will be performing at Shuba's. Tickets are on sale now, and you can get more information at chicagopodcastfestival.org.
Even to this day, I don't understand how I got where I am. From 1982 until 1995, I was ministered to 95 inmates who were put to death by lethal injection. I never intended to do 95. In fact, I didn't intend to do one, but it happened. After each execution, I made a tape on everybody that I walked with to the death chamber. I knew that I had to talk to somebody. And the only thing in my house at that time was a tape recorder. Some of these are well-known people, some of them are unknown, and then there are others I know were not guilty of the crime for which they were put to death.
We get back into my June conversation with doc filmmaker Steve James with that clip, the opening scene, in fact, from his 2008 doc co-directed by Peter Gilbert, At the Death House Door. The voice you heard was Carol Pickett, who for 15 years served as Death House chaplain to the infamous Walls Prison Unit in Huntsville, Texas. As I said to James at the time, you hear in that clip all the different elements at play and the different storylines the film will ultimately explore. The death penalty itself and the movement to abolish it, people who have been executed despite there being severe doubts about their guilt, and of course that chaplain, Carol Pickett himself, a fascinating character. Given all the directions the film could have gone, I wanted to know how he and Gilbert made the choices they did when approaching the material.
You know, what was interesting, I mean, it's a really good question because I remember that it was actually, I think, Gordon Quinn and I who had a meeting with folks from the Tribune. They wanted to pitch this idea of actually doing a film about the Carlos de Luna investigation because they did like a 3 or 4 part series and the idea was they were looking into, you know, everybody wants to find the kind of the perfect story of someone who's been executed where, you know, innocence is completely proven after the fact. And they were looking for that. Now, Carlos didn't quite end up being everything they wanted, but they thought, this is an amazing story, and it is. And so they were telling us all about the story over lunch that we had with them. And I'm thinking the entire time that they're telling me the story, I'm thinking, you know, this is a good story, but I've seen a number of films about wrongful convictions, if not executions, and I'm not sure raising money for yet another one is going to be easy. And then right in the middle of their telling us about Carlos, they said, oh, and there's this interesting guy who is a part of our story. His name is Carol Pickett, and he was the preacher, and he was the death house chaplain, and he spent, you know, with all these 95 men. And so he starts telling about, and he says, oh, and he, nobody knows about this because he kept them secret all these years, but he would make these little recordings. And so we've heard the one about Carlos, and it's really interesting. And I was like, well, that's the film we want to make. And I said, I think Carlos could be a part of that story, but that's a story I don't know anything about and that I think people would be utterly fascinated. And we could, you know, which you have to consider, we could maybe raise money to do that. And because the Tribune wasn't going to pay us to make this film. And so I came back from that and was talking to Peter about it. And it just so happened that Peter had read Carol Pickett's book and they didn't say anything about a book he'd written. I was like, the guy's written a book? He's like, oh yeah, it's a really interesting book because Peter had done a film about the death penalty, another film about the death penalty. So he was very versed in the subject. So I got the book, read the book, and it was just like, oh my God, this would be great. And so that's kind of the genesis of it. And I think that what became fascinating for us in making the film was, yes, we wanted to tell the story of Carlos mainly because Carlos meant so much to Pickett, that he was of the 95 inmates, he was the most significant inmate in terms of his experience of this duty he had done for all these years. But the other thing that really fascinated about us was is that here was this guy, Carol Pickett, who started out a pro-death penalty minister, and he had his own reasons for feeling that way, a grandfather who'd been murdered, a strict disciplinarian father, so he was a very conservative religious, you know, preacher, and he got this job, and over the years of doing this job, it took this major toll, and it also changed him. And I think we love the idea of sort of telling the story of what it means to not be the person who's executed or the family of the person executed, but the people who are actually engaged in doing the executions. Like, what is that about? And what is the toll that ultimately takes? And how does that change you? And so that's, Carlos is a big part of it, but we probably wouldn't even dealt with Carlos had he not been so significant to Pickett.
We were talking about the cinematography and the editing and that approach. Obviously not a traditional documentary in the sense of, maybe something like Hoop Dreams where it's about time moving forward and you're following events and there's some exposition. It's also not a Frederick Wiseman style observational purely just sit back and let things happen either. You are framing events and trying to tell a story that lets you flex some different muscles as a documentarian. Better muscles, worse muscles, just different muscles?
Well, no, I think a number of the films of mine that people might be most aware of, I mean, Hoop Dreams by far the most aware of, tend to be more in the verite tradition. They're not strictly verite because, frankly, we interview people. You know, I like talking to people. And strict verite observational cinema, you don't do that. It's like against the rules or whatever. But they're verite-driven. They follow people over time, and they're scene-based. I think what excited both of us about this was exactly that. There is a story that's unfolding over time, which is this investigation and the impact of that investigation on Carlos's family, particularly his sister. So there is there is a story that kind of unfolds during this, but there's this parallel story, which is Pickett's history, his personal journey, which took place mostly all in the past. And Peter and I were excited about flexing those different muscles because I don't want to, you know, I as a filmmaker, just speaking for myself, I don't want to make the same kind of films over and over, and the only difference being the subject matter. I like the idea of trying different kinds of film. And in this film, one of the really interesting challenges was that because we were filming Pickett listening to these tapes of executions that he had been bore witness to and then recorded in the immediate aftermath, and he was listening to tapes that he had never listened to. He had recorded these tapes, put them in a box, and never listened to them again. They were therapy for him at the time. And so we were having him go back through certain select executions with us in his little office, in his home, and listening to these tapes for the first time. And so one of the challenges of that became, how do we document that in a way that's truthful, even though it's a created situation for our film? And so we really set about like making sure that we were there to kind of capture him listening as much as anything. And that became a kind of an exciting challenge. And we would occasionally stop and talk to him about what he was thinking as he listened to tapes that he recorded many years earlier.
As I began to pray, he was seated on the side of the bunk. I was holding both of his hands. When I finished, he had gone down to his knees on the cold rock cement floor.
Well, I love the thought, too, that he's kind of his own documentary prayer. Filmmaker or documentarian, yes. Right? In that he's the only person who witnessed these events. And that tape recording from the time he felt compelled, partly due to, through catharsis, it was like a therapy for him, but also I think he just had to get it
on record.
It's the only record of it. And he talks about how throughout the film that he's not, he doesn't describe himself as political. And he even says at one point blatantly that he's not an activist, even though we see him actually coming to Chicago and speaking
and becoming
very
one.
Actively on behalf of, you know, an advocate against the death penalty. But he mentions that about not being an activist, and I'm just curious how much of, as we've talked about this a little bit, how much of your role as a filmmaker, how important is activism? I don't see this film necessarily, one of the things I love about it is that I think it's very poetic and very philosophical and not ultimately about a call to action at the end of the day, though different people can respond to it however they choose. But I do wonder how much, as an objective for you, is it important in a film like this and others?
I mean, I was kind of inclined against the death penalty for the most part, but it wasn't. I was, if you said, are you for or against death penalty, I would say I'm against it. But if you dug much deeper, I wouldn't have had much to say, honestly, about it. It's not an issue that was a burning issue at all for me. It was more so, I think, for Peter, because he'd done this other film. But for me, it was not a burning issue. I was, which is kind of why putting Carlos de Luna's story of what I think was clearly a wrongful execution front and center and making that the film wasn't ultimately a film I would have wanted to do, even though I think that's an entirely worthwhile film to have been done. I was much more interested in the psychological dimension of a guy who went through this and was on the other side of that. And I think Peter was very much on board with that as well. I don't think of my work in general as activist, because I tend to define activist work as having a clear agenda. And if I have a qualm with activist documentary filmmaking, it's not generally the view of the film, because generally speaking, I'm kind of with them. It's the reduction of complexity to fit an agenda. And sometimes it's a lack of journalistic fundamentals, you might say, that I think serve even non-journalistic films, if you will. And so a lot of the films I've done are very much, they're about things that are, you know, you could say are issues. But I like to think that they're stories first and foremost, and that the issues grow out of a connection and, you know, an involvement with people's lives instead of the opposite. I don't say, oh, I want to do a film about this issue and I want to find the right story that illustrates it. That's not generally how I think.
So I think it's clear from the two films we've talked about so far that you start from a position of natural curiosity. You don't have an agenda. You don't even have kind of your thoughts on the subject all in mind or all filled out. And this process of making the film is going to be your process of coming to a deeper understanding of that. And I think we then see that really amplified in a couple films where you become a character in the film. They really are about your personal journey and exploration and kind of reckoning with your own past a little bit. And that brings us to another film of yours I love, 2002. I want to talk about Stevie. And we're talking about flexing muscles, and this is a different muscle where now you're a character within the film. And just naturally, your natural instinct, is that something you are comfortable with? Or are you a person who, as you were in the filming process or the editing process, looking at these films, you were hesitant about but forced yourself to do?
Yeah, more of the latter. I mean, like with Stevie, so I think, how many people I don't want to ask that, actually.
You should all see it.
I never want to ask how many people have seen a film. That's always a mistake to do. But let me just briefly set up what Stevie is so that you can understand what the point I'm making. So Stevie is a film that started out, like Hoop Dreams did, as a short, and then ended up quite a bit longer. Stevie was going to be a portrait of this kid that, when I was in Southern Illinois going to school, and my wife worked in social services, and she got me involved in the Big Brother program. And so I ended up being a big brother to this kid named Stephen Fielding, who was not easy kid to be a big brother to. Because my wife worked in social services, they gave me the hardest kid they had because they thought she would help me with him, which she did, but it was still hard. So I was his big brother for 2.5-3 years, moved to Chicago, started my career, did Hoop Dreams, and then 10 years later, after leaving Southern Illinois, I went back with the idea. I was being brought back there for something related to Hoop Dreams, and I reconnected with Stevie with the idea that I hadn't seen him in all those years, and because I literally hadn't been back to Southern Illinois in all those years, but I reconnected with him with the idea that, and I thought, oh, it'd be fun to just do a little portrait of, like, where is he at now 10 years later, looking back on who he was when I was his big brother, and didn't shoot a single frame of film of him when I was his big brother. So it was going to be a short. I went back. It was a sobering experience when I first went there, and Peter Gilbert, who was one of the DPs on this and was early on involved, and then Dana and Gordon Quinn ended up becoming kind of replacing him in a sense and being more involved, you know, heavily involved later. But Peter and Adam Singer, again, from going back to Hoop Dreams, they both said, well, you haven't seen him in 10 years. I think we should film you, like, seeing him. And I was like, oh, no, I don't want to. No. Want that. He goes, no, just, you know, and they were like, no, you should just have it. You don't have to use it, but just have it because you should have it because you never know. And so I was like, okay, all right. So they did. And in my mind, I was thinking, I'll never use this because I don't want to be in it. I'm going to narrate it. I thought I would narrate it personally even, but I'm not going to be in it because I was one of these filmmakers that never, ever wanted to be in my films. I did not think of myself as Michael Moore or anybody like that. And anyway, as it transpired, though, is they got that, and then there was a hiatus in filming because I went off to do something else that I couldn't film. And then when I got back to this film, Stevie had literally just been arrested and charged with sexually molesting his cousin. And so then it led to this decision about whether to continue to make the film or not. And in conversations with him and in conversations with my colleagues and in conversations with myself, we kind of decided to go forward and do the film. And at that point, I decided, okay, if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to do this film, then I actually should be in the film. I was thankful that they had gotten me to be filmed before. And what governed that decision was, in part, is that I suddenly was now being thrust back into a role of being like a big brother again. I was trying to, with advice from Judy, my wife, who works with this population, she'd been working with sex offenders now for years, as it turns out. I was now trying to be a big brother and be involved in his life, and if I was going to document his life, then I felt like an obligation to document what I was also trying to do, however ineffectual I might be. And if you see this film, you will see great ineffectualness. So it felt like the only honest way to tell this story, because I like to say that a better person would have probably not made this film at that moment point. They probably would have said, you know what, I'm going to help him, but I'm not going to make a film about it. But I made a film about it.
Well, this conundrum is one of the fascinating things about the film. And regardless of how much you initially saw yourself personally involved, it was certainly a personal essay. It was driven by your own kind of personal desire to go back and look at your past and to look at Stevie. But then because of that crime, it does become more of an event-driven. Things are unfolding that I need to capture and weave into that. And the way these lines blur, I think, is really fascinating. And I want to cue up the scene. I think, do we have the "This Ain't Your Life" scene? Looks like we do. This is a scene where, as you're talking about the different roles you played, thrust back into being kind of a big brother and a legal advisor occasionally as well. You are in a office here with his lawyer and Stevie. And
public defender.
His public defender, who is ostensibly giving him some bad news that a confession that he had written that they thought they were going to be able to dismiss is now going to be back in. And he's kind of giving him how he thinks he can proceed. And you have different thoughts on that. And let's just go ahead and watch that.
The alternative is the Supreme Court will decide to hear the appeal, in which case it wouldn't come back here for at least a year. In another year, I don't know. There might be the urge to have this put behind him and all that business, so I'm not trying to, you know, give you false hopes or anything like that.
This is where I feared the meeting would go.
I think you're probably right to have this heard by a judge as opposed to a jury. And quite honestly, I've won cases with judges. Judges don't wet themselves when they hear what the charges are. I mean, the charges they're appalling, you know.
Are you willing to address with him the question of if this comes back for trial, the potential realities of...
Oh, well... Yeah, I don't think it's a secret that, particularly with the statement, if the statement's in there, odds are good you'd be convicted. That statement is damaging, okay?
So some kind of offer is saying he's willing to plead guilty in exchange for probation and counseling or
Well,
therapy.
Probation and counseling, I don't think the state would be in a position to take that. They would probably insist on penitentiary time.
But they might be willing to reduce the amount of penitentiary time.
I think they would be amenable to an offer, but I haven't received any indication from Stevie that he's, you know, in a position to make one.
So a lot of complicated things going on in that scene, starting with the fact
that
you are...
That's a great scene you picked there.
Thanks.
I like that. I mean, I'm glad you picked that scene.
We've chatted about it before. It was a key scene for me when I taught a class at the University of Chicago's Graham School for Continuing Education on cinema verite, and because of the lines that are blurred there, that was one I really wanted to emphasize with the class, because you're starting from the perspective of being a friend or at least a confidant here to Stevie. But then making things even more difficult is that you're not someone who is looking to try to get him out of jail time. You do feel that he is guilty and he deserves some kind of punishment. But you're also there as a documentarian. You're there as a filmmaker, and you could have made the decision to just let this whole scene unfold and let his case unfold and not be involved in any way. And now, not only are you influencing his life, you're obviously more directly even influencing where your movie's going.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, this scene is a perfect example of what we've been talking about, like you said, which is I could have made this film and not been in it at all. And you could have seen none of that, right? And even if I said those things that you see in the film to the lawyer and sort of interrupted the meeting and said, hey, are you going to, you know, basically tell him the truth or not? That could have been left out. You could re-edit all of that in a way so that you get all that information that happens in that scene, and you never hear from me, see me, or anything. It could have been totally done that way. But that felt fundamentally dishonest. And I was involved in his life, and so I felt like if I was going to be involved in his life, if I wasn't going to sit back passively and just document what happened to him, that I needed to take account of my involvement, that was necessary. And in some ways, you know, without question, the safer way to make this film would have been to keep myself out of it. And I could have made a film without myself in it. And I think that film would have been less honest, for sure. I think it would have been less interesting. But it also would have been safer for me, because this was a film, I mean, a lot of people have seen this film, a lot of people have not seen the film, but of the people who have seen the film, a lot of them like it and respond to it. There are a lot of people, though, that look at this film and go, you know, my favorite quote from a media educator group that saw it, and I saw this like online or something, I had no idea they were watching, it was like Media Education Association, whoever they are, I don't know. And they had then put comments afterwards about what they thought of the film. And some of them were positive. One of them was like, Steve James should be in jail alongside Stevie, you know, for having made this movie, because they felt like I just totally exploited this awful situation. And I was like terrible at helping him, and, you know, a lot of reasons. And there I am right there being, you know, that guy.
What do you think about that, Stevie?
I don't know.
I guess what I want you to think about, Stevie, is...
Thank hell, this ain't your life that we're talking about. This is mine, man.
Well, I know that, but I guess I want you to think about whether you want to roll the dice like this, or whether you want to think about how much time...
I rolled the dice too much, and I ain't came up with nothing yet.
Well, exactly.
So just for the record, I don't think Steve James should be in jail, and I do highly recommend you seeking out Stevie if it's a film you haven't seen. That's not the end of my conversation with Steve James, but that's all we've got time to share this week. My thanks to the International Documentary Association, their conversation series, and Chicago's Cartemquin Films for organizing that look back at James' career. Thanks to the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs as well. James's new film, Abacus Small Enough to Jail, is playing the Chicago International Film Festival going on now. Details about Tuesday, October 18th screening of Abacus is available at chicagofilmfest.com. We will link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And that is another Steve James film I can definitely recommend. Earned some acclaim recently at the Toronto Film Festival as well, but another insightful James documentary that deals with some of his common themes, including social justice and the search for truth and, of course, community. It's about the Abacus Federal Savings Bank in New York City, which was the only financial institution that actually ended up facing criminal charges because of the subprime mortgage crisis. Again, definitely recommended if you have time to check it out at the festival. Send comments about this show to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting. My co-host Josh Larson is at Larson on Film. Our website, filmspotting.net, is also where you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please check out the Filmspotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Filmspotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out wide this weekend, The Accountant, starring Ben Affleck and Anna Kendrick. Kevin Hart, What Now?, his stand-up show, and Max Steel. In limited release, Desierto, the border-crossing drama written and directed by Jonas Cuarón and starring Gael García Bernal. Next week, we'll get back to our more conventional format, my conversation with director Kelly Reichardt and thoughts on her new one, Certain Women. Plus, Josh and I get into the second film in our Luis Buñuel marathon, 1954's Robinson Crusoe. If you want to play along, that one is available through our partner for this marathon, Mubi. At Mubi.com is where you can get two of the films, including Crusoe, from this Buñuel marathon. That film is also available to rent through Netflix. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week comes from Shovels and Rope from the album Little Seeds. More information at shovelsandrope.com. filmspotting.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.